highbrow drivel of the highest order. An absolute disgrace.
Isn't that some good highbrow?
Well, I never. Absolute drivel, I do say, my good sirs. Now that's some good ass highbrow drivel, you hear me?
Welcome to the highbrow drivel.
Hello. It's been so lovely to have so many new listeners in the last episode. So if you are a new listener, welcome. I hope you enjoy it. If you're one of our old friends who has shared the episode, I do really appreciate it. So thank you for that too. As always, I'll start off the top by reminding you it's a new podcast and growing. And the quickest way for me to do that is if you are liking the episodes to subscribe. And if you're a subscriber, please tell a friend. I really appreciate it, and I'd like to thank you for that. On today's episode, it's crazy to think that this year, amongst all of the ridiculousness, climate policy has seemed to have taken a back seat. But it's obviously such an important existential issue that I wanted to keep the conversation going. So I was lucky enough to be able to talk to Ross Grier from the Scottish Greens Party, who was once the youngest Scottish Minister of Parliament. And Alex Keeley, who is a comedian who is so clever and so smart when he talks about politics, that when my family first visited me in London, the only person on the gig that they came to see that they spoke about was Alex. So it's great to actually get him on board and hopefully legitimize my comedy to my family. I won't keep you any longer. I hope you enjoy the episode. So I think today one of the things I really want to focus on is the political mood and why climate policy has seemed to move slower than I guess the public will seems to. I think there's been so much discussion about how we convince climate change deniers that it is a thing. But when you look at the stats, there's been study after study with various questions asked in various parts of the world, and almost invariably in the first world at least, the answer is most people think this is an important thing that we need to do something about, and yet the politics doesn't seem to match that mood. And it feels, personally, if I was to try and like compare it into something that I maybe understand a bit better, it feels a bit like we've all had this really long house party that somewhere along the line, the bender's gone too long and shit's on fire, and we're all going around going, yeah, we should probably clean this up. And the most is like some people are there, you know, putting trash in bags and doing like tiny little bits. But at the same time, you know, there's a hole in the carpet and all of the furniture's been ruined. And we're like, well, actually, we probably need a professional to do that. And meanwhile, while all this is happening, the political class, particularly of the major parties, are so busy trying to get laid in your parents' bedroom that they're just like, no, we just let the party keep going. Why does that seem to be the case?
I mean, the first thing is, like, you know, if folk are still climate deniers, like, don't fucking waste your time on them, right? We've got an overwhelming majority of people who now at least accept the basics of the science. And given that the basics of the science tell us that the world is ending, it's pretty good that we've got a majority of people who at least believe that, right? The folk that are left, like, it's increasingly becoming a kind of fringe conspiracy theory that overlaps with like Bill Gates' 5G microchips and pizza restaurants running child trafficking rings and stuff. So like, we don't need to waste our time on them. The big issue though is that what you said, like the folk who realize that there's this massive problem, like existential problem, and that something should get done about it. But it's when we start talking about, right, here are the specific things we need to do. That's when they start to back off, or when they don't vote for the politicians who are actually committed to doing that stuff, or where they don't get involved in the campaigns to do it. I think there's like three bits to it. Part of it is that the public are convinced that saving the planet means they personally need to sacrifice, that the smelly environmentalists are going to come and steal your car, they're going to make you hand stitch your own hair shirts and force feed you humans. they like logically and morally get that something needs to be done. And they increasingly realize that their kids need them to act. You know, we used to say that, like, you have to be nice to your kids so they'll get you a spot in a nice care home. Now you need to be nice to your kids so that they'll bother to wheel you away from rising sea levels or the approaching wildfire or something. But, like, you can't forget that that doesn't exist in a silo. We can't like blame individuals. The reason people believe all that stuff is because of the massive institutional resistance of political elites, media elites, economic elites, who are both directly resisting to anything that we try and do to save the world, but are also indirectly doing it by creating distractions, culture war issues, dividing us by race, dividing us by gender and all that. That like they cause those distractions so that people think, yeah, we should probably do something about the climate. But hold on, I'm going to get really angry about those like six desperate asylum seekers who came here because they just needed to survive. Apparently that's a better use of the front page of a major national newspaper than the fact that the world is actually ending.
Well, it's also like, look, if you're gonna do right wing ethno nationalism, at least think about the climate change implications of it, right? There's going to be if one Syrian war is going to wind you up in terms of like bringing people into safety, like think what the destruction. Anyway, I mean, it's a jokey reference to eco-fascism there, but
that's a huge bit of it. Like the Syrian crisis in 2015, and then the refugee crisis in the Mediterranean in Europe, right? That was at its peak in 2015. A million refugees arrived in Europe through the south and the east, and the whole continent of half a billion people, like collectively, all the governments at least, lost their shit and tried to fortify a continent. That was for a million people. At absolute minimum, we're talking about 300 million climate refugees by like 2040. Like if a million people caused a continent's worth of governments in the richest continent in the world to lose their shit and try to fortify the sea, I don't think we're going to be able to cope with helping 300 million.
I do think that gets into one of the issues I'm so curious about this, which is that there are rumors and occasionally direct examples of politicians who say things publicly and believe a different thing privately. And I think my favorite example of this, and by favorite, I mean the example that makes me pull my fucking hair out the most, is back a few years ago when Tony Abbott was still Prime Minister of Australia. There was just, and again, the kind of basic level of incompetence that you only get from like the top conservative right wing governments, even at like a center left level, they're not this fucking stupid. But there was a press conference happening, and they were talking about Pacific Islands and the fact that they were complaining about, let's be honest, it was probably Australia's refugee policy, although I'll need to fact check that. But the Pacific Islands were complaining about something, and the camera stopped, but the boom mic was still on. And Peter Dutton, one of the senior Australian parliamentarians at the time, and still unfortunately the human potato that represents us, he looked to Tony Abbott, the then Prime Minister, and kind of gave him a wink and a nudge and said, "Well, they're not going to matter too much. You can't be too busy with politics when there's water lapping at your doors," directly acknowledging that he expects rising sea levels to affect them. But then publicly we'll say, no, we don't think this is an issue. Like, is that a huge, I guess, Ross, you're the best person to answer this. Is there a huge known problem with people who are in politics and will admit in private there is a problem but would never put their politics to that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, you've got this, like, strange mix of people at the head of governments, particularly when it's, like, governments of the right, where, like, a lot of them are intelligent people. It would be stupid of us to assume that they're all stupid. There are, like, obvious exceptions to that. Like, the UK Prime Minister is, like, an excellent example of someone who just has failed up his entire life. To the point where he's now, like, he's in charge of the country in the way that, you know, that way, like, you sometimes have a dream and you wake up and you're naked and you're on a stage and you didn't even think you were in this play at all. And, like, that's, his life just keeps going to the point where he's like, oh, shit, I'm here. But like, on the whole, they're not stupid people. And they get it. The problem is, it's against taking this kind of action that's inherently long term, right? It takes a while to save the planet. We've only got 10 years left, but it takes a while to save the planet, and it takes a while for the good stuff to happen from those actions. That's completely against their interests. It's completely against their short term electoral interests, because no matter what, every couple of years you need people to vote for you. And as politicians, the only measurement that ever ultimately counts in our jobs is votes, right? If you don't get votes, you can't keep doing the job, and that's it. So it's against that. But it's also like the wider support system, the ecosystem around traditional parties of government is full of like the donors, the economic elites, who are the people actually killing the planet. So it's against their economic interests, which means they won't give you any money for your political campaign. So it's not really in your political interest either. So you can be smart enough to acknowledge that there's a problem, but also like so craven and self-interested enough to think, nah, I'd actually rather have a ministerial car for the next 10 years and then, you know, fuck my kids.
Yeah, or like my kids are going to be fucked anyways. What could I, like, even at like government minister level, there can be some of that denial of self-agency in the problem, right? You're just like, well, if China, you know, the like galaxy brain version of that is, well, if China doesn't do anything about it or whatever, then, you know, what could Britain, so even like the British business secretary can pretend that they're impotent rather than like a cabinet minister.
But I at least respect the folk who are craven and self-interested enough to consistently take a public line of saying, nah, do you know what, actually, we're not going to do enough about it. The ones who really piss me off now, and this is becoming way more common on both like the centre-left and centre-right and even the more radical right, is they'll stand up in front of one audience and say, do you know what, we are totally committed to tackling this crisis. We are going to save the world. This is going to be the greenest government ever. Like the government here in Scotland, they do that. Like a centre-left government who declared a climate emergency and who talk a brilliant game and be really rhetorically supportive of the school climate strikers and stuff. And then we'll go to Oil and Gas UK's conference and say to them, we are full square behind you, maximum extraction for 2050 and beyond. We'll keep campaigning to get you tax cuts. Don't worry, you've got a friend in us. The folk who can be hypocritical enough to say two totally different things on an issue literally existential as the future of our planet, like that's asshole behavior way more than the people who are just consistently lying.
But how, you know, how do you make the financial case for Scottish independence without the oil, right? What Nicola Sturgeon's real strategy is an independent Scotland underwater than a
Well, I mean, that one, I've got to say, like, so the Green Party in Scotland do actually support independence, but for like totally different reasons to Sturgeon and the SNP. I mean, the reality is, compare like Scotland and New Zealand. So Scotland's got more natural resources if you take away fossil fuels. It's got a slightly bigger population. We've got a lot going for us. New Zealand is clearly like a developed first world country and a great place to live. So like the idea that Scotland couldn't be at least like equal to New Zealand as an independent country, even without the oil and gas, that's a nonsense. But the part of the calculation that they make is, oh, well, if we can't get the economic elites on side, then we're probably not going to win. Like, I think that's wrong, but that's totally the calculation that they're making. Is like I have no doubt that there are people in the SNP who, if they achieve independence, folk like me will be immediately shown the door, and they'll be trying to get like Shell and BP and KPMG to come and write the tax bill.
100%, yeah.
It is a weird position to be in the Scotland case in particular, where... And I guess there's a lot of global political fights like this where, like, oh, the value of you winning this fight is kind of dependent on there being a planet for this future to fucking exist, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So much of politics in the past 20 years has been, like, one of those, you know, episodes of Game of Thrones where they're, like, squabbling about, like, who gets this castle in the south, and there's just, like, a full zombie army coming from the north. It's like... this feels like a subplot. Everything is a subplot compared to this thing.
Yeah. What, one of the questions I had in terms of the way that the politics of this discussion has been framed and I think one of the ways that politicians have been able to not or avoid taking responsibility at their end is that I think it's been clear for a long time that the only way we're going to make meaningful change on this is political systemic action. I mean, it's all good and well if you want to pat yourself on the back and do some recycling, but that's not the game changer here, right? We need actual political decisions that impact industry and force industry to comply. But all of the focus on a discussion level seems to be about these tiny little personal things that people can do. And that's created its own wealth of problems in terms of, like, you know, someone like Elon Musk is a celebrity born out of the desire for people to want a way to make personal action. He was considered an eco-hero at one point, not too long ago, like a decade ago. And now he's just proved himself to be
I think we can all say Elon Musk is like Richard Branson for millennials, but he's only able to exist because there was this whole framing of the debate as, oh, you know what, we've got this huge problem with climate change that is caused by consumerism. How do we fix it? We buy our way out of the problem.
It's such an easy cop-out, though. I mean, like, Elon Musk, like, the real world comparison is Richard Branson, right? Like, the better one is, if you've ever seen the Simpsons episode where Homer ends up working for Hank Scorpio, he's accidentally gone to work for a James Bond villain. Like, that's Elon Musk, right? But why corporations love the idea that you can just buy your way out of it, that it's all about individual lifestyle changes, is obviously that absolves them of the responsibility, right? Two-thirds of all emissions, not all emissions in the last year or the last decade or the last century, but since the beginning of the industrial era of mankind, two-thirds of all of our emissions came from 90 companies. And there's like a list of them. We know exactly who they are, and they are overwhelmingly responsible for this crisis, and they've got incredibly, obscenely, unimaginably rich as a result of that. But they don't want to give that up. They don't want to give the power up. They don't want to give the wealth up. They want to keep doing what they're doing. In fact, all of the ones that still exist of that 90, which is most of them, pretty much all their business plans are still committed to like wrecking the planet decades after it's too late to stop it. So they love the idea that the way that we'll solve the climate crisis is if we ban plastic straws, which is just such obvious bullshit. Because the way we'll actually solve the climate crisis is if we seize these companies' assets and use their wealth, use their assets and redeploy them urgently, because we've only got 10 years left, less than that now, 9 years, redeploy them immediately to doing all the shit that will undo the damage they've caused. And that doesn't actually negatively affect the rest of the world, right? What that will actually do is it will create more jobs in lasting industries. It will improve people's local environments and their health as a result. A lot of these companies are involved in some of the most horrendous human rights abuses as well to get access to these resources that they're burning. Like, this is why they love the whole like ban plastic straws to save the planet. It's you personally didn't recycle, like your plastic waste has just choked a seal, so you need to, you know, guilt yourself into personal action. Nah, that's all nonsense. Like the solutions to solving the planet are actually really pretty simple, but they're not ones that we will ever come to by consensus. The only way we can save the planet is by conflict, like direct conflict with the people who caused this problem. Like, we have an enemy. If we're going back to your James Bond villain scenario, there are a whole bunch of James Bond villains who are out in the open lighting matches and flicking them onto the planet, like deliberately setting it in fire in front of all of us, and people are already dying. We know who they are, and we know how to stop them. We just need to actually get around to doing it, because there's like a clock running now.
I don't know how to follow that other than to take arms. It is a very powerful message. I wonder, in terms of these kind of, like you said, there are these James Bond villains who are impacting the discussion and benefiting directly on a daily basis from the destruction of the planet. A secondary tool that, and I think a tool that they've used super successfully that you mentioned earlier is to make everybody think of the cost of changing to a more renewable, sustainable culture, right? Every time there is things floated about how we change that, everybody will talk about the cost, the loss of jobs in the mining industry. And, you know, Australia's Prime Minister, now Prime Minister, not too long ago, fucking took a lump of coal into Parliament and said, this is coal, don't be scared of it, which makes me angry enough also because everybody hates a fucking prop comic. You've got these guys doing this sort of this framing of the debate as economics now, what nobody seems to be doing, or what we seem to have a lot of poor success with doing, is going, okay, even if the way you framed the cost is right, which often I don't believe it is, but even if you did, what is the cost of not acting? Like, we don't talk about that. And it's like, if you had a car and you took it to a mechanic and the guy was like, oh, you've got no oil in the car, you should probably top that up. It'll cost you $60. If you drive that car for another year and then the fucking motor burns out, that's going to cost you a lot more. And we have that directly now, and we still don't seem to be good at talking about it.
Yeah, and it's like the idea that they're saying, do you know what? The status quo, the world as we've got it, this is wonderful, and these horrible greenies want to come and make everything worse. Well, as like you said, there's no status quo, right? The world is rapidly getting worse in the climate crisis. The climate is already breaking down. So we can either have that complete breakdown, like existential crisis within our lifetimes, or we can do something about it. But take all that aside for a moment. Like, the economy that we've got right now, globally, and in countries like the UK and Australia, it sucks, right? One in four children in the UK live in poverty. This is the sixth richest country in the world, and we have hundreds of thousands of children going to bed hungry each night, right? The economy absolutely, radically sucks for most people. The people who it works great for are the same people who are wrecking the planet, tiny, tiny number of incredibly rich folk. And this is why, like, this is why there's so much resistance to it. And this is why these people put so much time and energy into, like, media propaganda. Like, ExxonMobil, the fossil fuel company, they knew about the effect that the climate crisis was having. They knew about global warming before almost anyone else. And if you go on the hashtag ExxonNew on like Twitter or something, they are so terrified of the damage it's doing to them now that people know they suppressed this evidence. That most of what you see on hashtag ExxonNew are paid advertisements from Exxon about how, oh, they didn't really know and they're super green and it's all absolute bullshit. What we're seeing as the Greens, and I don't mean my party, I mean like the broad environmental movement, is, do you know what? The world can actually be better for people and the planet, right? We can do something that means children don't go to bed hungry because their parents have decent jobs and they live in a society that they can actually afford to. Like, all this stuff comes together. Like, we will solve the climate crisis by making the world better for our societies. And like, that's what gets me about the climate deniers, right? There's that the meme that goes around of, you know, like, what if it was all a hoax? What if we just made the world better for nothing?
Yeah. With, like, all these carbon fossil fuels are finite anyway, so it's just like got to change at some point.
I think that's a really great point, Alex. Right? Is that it is one of those things that happens in terms of. When they frame this debate, they frame it as if that we could keep going the way that we're going anyway, which is completely untrue. I wonder about that in terms of, like, how do we actually start getting people to talk about that and talk about that in terms of the way that our economic system is tied to a way that restricts climate change action. I think it's very hard to make meaningful changes to the climate when you have an economic model that is dependent on infinite growth with finite resources.
Yeah,
like there's stuff you can do, like, within the confines of the system we've got at the moment, right? So to give you, like, a shamelessly self-promotional example, my party, so the Scottish Greens, we negotiated in the last annual budget for our country, that from this year, it'll be introduced a little bit later now because of the plague, but from this year, everyone under the age of 19 will be able to use the bus for free in Scotland. The government will pay for it, right? And we're doing that because that will obviously reduce carbon emissions, there'll be less parents driving their kids around and all that, but also because, like, it will make their lives better. Like, huge number of families, like in Glasgow, 40% of families don't even have access to a car. And those families will now be able to afford getting the bus because it's now free for their kids. And it's about tying these initiatives that will, like, literally save the world bit by bit by bit with the fact that this will actually tangibly improve people's lives, because the people who can't afford to use public transport that's increasingly expensive in this country because it's run by private companies are also the people who suffer the most because of the air pollution, because everyone else is driving past in their car. So you can do stuff like that, and you can connect people's direct material interests with the stuff that will save the world. That will get you pretty far. It won't get you all the way there. Like, the reality is we need such a complete transformation in our economic system that we need a complete political transformation as well. And the reason that like that's so hard is because most people don't think they have any power, right? People have been systematically alienated from political systems and made to think that actually they personally can't make a difference. Well, we all totally can, right? And collectively, we can make a huge difference. Bob Crowe was a trade union leader in the UK, who died a couple of years ago, who had a pretty blunt turn of phrase, but he said, you know, if we all spit together, we can drown the bastards. Like, people have far more power. The population as a whole have far more power than economic elites because there's hardly any of them. And if we all come together, we can actually not only materially make everyone's lives better, the one in four kids who go to bed hungry won't need to go to bed hungry anymore, but we can save the planet at the same time. The challenge is, how do you convince people that they have that power when they've gone through their entire life, however long that's been, constantly disempowered economically or politically or whatever it is? Like, that's the big challenge for us. It's not convincing people to fly less or to recycle more, however worthy those things are. What we're actually trying to convince people now is, we've only got 10 years left. What we need is a revolution. The good thing is, there's enough of us for the revolution to actually work.
It's something I've only just thought of as you say this. I'm not sure if the question is going to come across right. But at the time that we're recording this, obviously, because this may come out a week later, but it was literally yesterday that cosplay revolutionaries dressed as Jamiroquai stormed the US Capitol, right? And I have a really interesting, I think it's really interesting the way that this feeling of disempowerment seems to be so tied to privilege, because, you know, I've felt for ages, not that I believe in or agree with, but I felt like for ages that at some point the way we were going would lead to some form of eco-terrorism over the last decade. I thought it was an inevitability, and it's not happened yet. But these fucking crybabies lose a legitimate election and they manage to take over Capitol Hill. There has to be something in that entitlement and that privilege and that being told that you are important empowers you to make those
unless we can have a secret police recruitment program for eco terrorists within the police. I'm afraid aren't going to have the advantage of the sort of clan sympathetic tendencies or apparently of like selfie taking police with the insurrectionist storming into Capitol Hill yesterday. I mean, it's just disgusting. But
it shows you, there's an interesting contrast though in like the approach of like, if you want to like take direct action on behalf of the environment, and like, what are you doing? Well, like, you might be like tying yourself to logging equipment to save an ancient rainforest or whatever. These guys, it's like, oh, what direct action did you take for your cause? Well, I dressed up as like a kind of Viking and then I smashed my way into a building, and once I got in there I realized that I had no plan whatsoever, and they all had guns.
But it was just like the policing was just absolute kid glove stuff that wouldn't have happened if it'd been a different group of protesters, let's say.
Oh yeah, I mean that's the privilege thing. Like, the obvious comparison there is like Black Lives Matter protesters. Like, the grim reality that we're all in no doubt about is, like, if Black Lives Matter protesters had tried to do that in the US Capitol, they would have been slaughtered. Like, they would have been killed. But if we're talking about compare the environmental movement to these guys, the environmental movement has been like infiltrated by the police for decades. Direct action protesters have been like brutalized by not just police action, but by the hired thugs of the companies that they're often up to protest against. Like, we shouldn't be in any doubt, like, that side of it is really, really hard. And that takes a lot of commitment from folk to do it. Like, the folk who do it, totally, totally admirable. But for every one person doing that, you can have 1,000 other people doing all sorts of other stuff in the movement. Like, the school climate strikers are, like, absolutely astounding in everything that they've managed to achieve. And like, they're not at that kind of like hardcore radical edge of direct action. Most of them would support that kind of stuff, I think. But they didn't even need to do that to totally shift the conversation, like totally shift the conversation on climate. They just walked out of school like that. The status quo is so terrified of any challenge whatsoever that all young people needed to do wasn't go like smash up the headquarters of an oil company. It was literally just walk out of their classrooms and like political and economic elites started freaking out about it. Problem is the plague has kind of like interrupted our ability to follow through on that and force them to actually, you know, take the action that we need to save the world.
Yeah, it's very hard to have a school strike when schools are out anyway.
Yeah.
What'd you do? I didn't go to school. I stayed at home. Weren't you supposed to be there anyway? Yeah, kind of a problem. I do wonder as well with the school strikers, it's actually a really, really good point you make about the impact they had with that kind of really simple but meaningful direct action. What I'm curious about with that is, again, at the top, we spoke about the fact that most people believe that climate change is something that we should do something about. But this seems to be a problem we're up against as well, right? Because they agree that, but then the public opinion on Greta Thunberg and the school strike was a lot more divided than the public opinion on climate change. And it's like we've got this generation of young people that we're trying to empower, and we're saying, you know, you can make the world a better place. Go out and make the world the place you want to see it. And then you're, oh, not like that. Could you just do it a bit silently? I don't want to have to face you while you're making your change. Like,
yeah, Martin Luther King had a great line on that in one of the letters that he wrote when he was in jail in Alabama, which I used as part of a sermon that I gave in my church one time. He said, you know, that in his case, talking about his struggle, he said that the black man's greatest opponent wasn't the Ku Klux Klan, it wasn't the White Citizens Council. It was moderates. It was white moderates who were telling them, no, not yet. No, not like this. And these people are going to look like such assholes, right? You look at public opinion back then, right? And like 60, 70, 80% of white Americans hated Martin Luther King. They opposed the Freedom Riders, the bus boycott and all that. How many people would admit now? Bear in mind, look, most of these people are still alive. It wasn't that long ago, right? His kids are like middle-aged. How many people would admit now that they were one of the white people counter-protesting, you know, with the signs that you can't even say what was on them, right? These people are going to look like such dicks. And really quickly, I think that's why opinion on it started to shift a little bit, because you've got a lot of folk who just feel so insecure that teenagers are telling them, nah, you've fucked it, guys. You've really fucked the world. And I'm 15, but I'm going to have to walk out of double English today to fix it for you. Thanks very much. And some folks' reaction to that is to lash out. Other folks' reaction, fortunately, more and more seems to be, oh, shit, actually, yeah, they've got a point. We need to do something about it. Like, there is no coincidence that 2019, when the climate strikes Greta Thunberg exploded, that's also the most successful year in the history of my political movement, in the history of green parties. Like, we had a green wave across Europe. We did well in loads of other countries, because suddenly all these school strikers who were too young to vote, their parents were at least listening to them, and some of them responded. And that's resulted in some people actually getting into various governments around the world who are at least trying to do something about this. So that there is positive change that comes out of this. And sometimes it's not direct and sometimes it's not quick, but like, it is happening. It is there's good stuff happening. For every like gammony old man who gets enraged at Greta Thunberg even being allowed to talk, there are a couple of others who have decided, you know what, they're going to listen to their kids or grandkids instead. And they're going to try in whatever way they can, and whether it's well-intentioned or misguided or whatever, they're always trying to do something about it now. And that's a way better place than we were a couple of years ago.
In terms of the change that needs to be made and the change that has started, obviously one of the things that I think a lot of us find tough is that actually, you know, to make change, what we need is bipartisan support, and bipartisan support in terms of the major parties as well as green parties around the world. And it seems like nobody that I talk to that has the right ideas has any access to the people we need to convince. I mean, this podcast is the exact embodiment of the kind of echo chamber we need to break out of. How do we influence the people who the conservatives care about? How do we influence the sort of people who the national trust.
You've got to use the national trust, and you've got to use like that slightly more like wildlife-y green spaces kind of that has like a chunk. You just got to use stuff like that where there's a chunk of like almost like center right ishness about that like group of people that use that, but it could still connect quite nicely to, I don't know. Yeah, that'd be my first one.
I just can't believe you think the podcast's an echo chamber, man. I mean, are you saying that you've not been using your time productively to cultivate an audience of conservative economic elites listening to this podcast? We've been in Washington for like 10 months. What have you been doing with your time, man?
Lure them in with a kind of culture war, free speech meta tag, and then like, boom, 20 minutes in, it's actually about climate economics.
Like, I only came on here because I fully expected that the chief exec of Shell would be listening to at least 15 minutes.
I would say, as a straight white man, I'm pretty much as close as the movement gets to people they will listen to. I mean, I do think that even that in and of itself is tangentially related but interesting in terms of, like the amount of friends of mine, in fact, if I'm going to be completely honest, I've not mentioned this before, but one of the main reasons I started this podcast is because I was sick of my friends recommending Joe Rogan episodes to me. And I was like, that motherfucker puts alt-right people and gives them a platform every week. And this is the best we've got. And they're people who agree with me politically. I was like, well, I mean, it's not that I'm ever going to compete with him, but at least I don't have to listen to his shit. I can just have the conversations myself.
Like the point that you make though about like bipartisanship and how do we reach out, like that's hard on so many levels. Like, obviously, it's just plain hard to persuade people of that political position to listen. But like, I've constantly found myself asking that question because a big part of green politics is this idea that we should do stuff collaboratively and by consensus, and consensus decision making is great. Problem is, like, I don't think there is a bipartisan solution to the crisis that we're in. Like, I don't think the right. I don't think in any way, shape, or form you can come up with a solution to the climate crisis that's compatible with right-wing politics. Because right-wing politics, like certainly right-wing economics and free market economics, is so dependent on the system that has caused it. It is the system that has caused this breakdown. So, like, you end up with a really difficult question there. Because say, right, obviously, if the only way that we're going to beat this, if we're saying the only way we can possibly beat this is just with overwhelming victories of radical left forces in elections and in street movements and stuff, I think we might be waiting a little bit too long. That might take longer than the time that we've got left, right? But if we're, on the other hand, saying, actually, what we need to do is reach across the aisle and have everyone from, like, folk at radical end of socialism like myself, and at least the kind of like center right folk, forget the radical right, but like even the center right, like they are the people who've been in power and who've caused the crisis. So do we try and compromise with them? Do we even have enough time to do that? Is that not morally at least a wee bit dubious? Like, because that's what I struggle with all the time. Like, do I bother trying to create a consensus in parliament around this issue? Is there even any hope of doing that? Or do you just fight like hell? Like, is this now just like a final cataclysmic confrontation between the forces who caused the crisis and the forces who want to stop it? Because I don't think that like we'll all be holding hands, skipping off into the sunset at the end of this.
I agree with you. I think it is probably, yeah. And it's one of those things where we've had the endangered planet Earth was, I think, Time Planet of the Year in maybe 1988, I believe. So we've had, you know, over 32 years, to make change, and it hasn't happened. So I guess it is probably time to get a bit more serious and a little bit less consensus orientated. My question is, what does that look like? Like, do you have to start bringing a child into parliament every day and slap them every time a green motion isn't passed and be like, this is what you're doing. Like, how do you actually get them to take it more serious?
Well, the last green bill that was passed in the Scottish Parliament actually banned hitting children under any circumstances. So probably skip over that.
But you're here to announce one crucial exception.
That was the one amendment that we got in was just, here's the specific set of circumstances. Now, but like, I mean, maybe it's not that, but maybe you bring the kids in and, like, that was the amazing thing about the climate strike movement was, so we brought a whole bunch of climate strikers into the Scottish Parliament to meet with politicians, to meet MSPs from across the parties. And I loved it. I loved how incredibly uncomfortable they made everyone. Like, because this is the thing, like, politicians on the whole, don't want to be dicks to children, especially not in public, right? They don't want people to see them blatantly being an asshole to kids in the way that they might be comfortable blatantly being an asshole to someone like me. And that's fine. That's like the game that we play sometimes. But we had, like, you know, 14-year-olds come in, and you had politicians from the SNP, so the centre-left party here in Scotland, or the government, who were saying, yeah, what you're doing is great. We've declared a climate emergency. We're dead serious about this. And the 14-year-olds turned around and went, yeah, but you're committed to taking as much oil and gas out of the North Sea as you can past 2050. And, like, I'm 14, and even I know that you can't do that and save the world. So what are you on about? And you just got this, and it just made them so awkward and embarrassed. And, like, shame isn't a good way of motivating the public. Like, environmental charities have made that mistake for decades, where they think they'll just shame people into giving them money and that's the way to do it. No, you can't shame the public into taking action, and you shouldn't shame the public into taking action. You can shame politicians and governments, though, and that kind of seems to be working when it's, like, 14-year-olds are doing it. So if the only role that I'm playing there is literally being the person with the pass who lets the 14-year-old into the building so that they can make them feel guilty, then, like, great. Like, if it works, it works.
Alex, I'm going to put you completely under the pump. I suggested slapping children. Ross has suggested bringing them in to talk to the politicians. Do you have a suggestion for a left-to-center idea that may help them take it more serious?
I don't know. Code all Amazon Alexas so that they only respond to child's commands until carbon goes down to 250 parts per million in the atmosphere, and so children are choosing the playlist until then. And I think, you know, a few hundred, you know, a decade of Baby Shark will maybe get politicians to do something.
Yes, just torture them with Baby Shark, maybe increasingly adding lyrics about how different wildlife is being made extinct by their direct choices.
Dirty gas.
See, BB is taking a really dark turn here.
Yeah.
I've got this image now of, like, the CBeebies bedtime story. Is just like they got, like, Tom Hardy in to do that. Could you imagine, like, they get Tom Hardy back in to do the story, but, like, it's not about teddy bears going on an adventure. It's about the extinction of the panda species because of our desperate need to cut down bamboo. Like,
one thing that I guess I wanted to ask both of you, and Alex, maybe you can go first with this one. We've seen governments this year have the power to put legislation in to protect social good when there is such an urgent demand from the public. And obviously, particularly when we're talking about the UK, they've not done it successfully, but they have also gone consistently directly against what they said was possible. Is that something that we can learn from and exert it, should that be a reason for us to exert more pressure? And how do you reckon we can do that?
Well, I mean, I think with regards to the UK, the thing I'm pessimistic about, and I think that you can look at in terms of the government's policies, obviously, like, in some ways, the government has, you know, stepped in and done some pretty radical things, and, you know, but basically most of the changes they've done have been these deliberate one-off ones. They don't want hangovers in. They don't want after this crisis has dissipated or whatever to you know, they're not been changing universal credit in, like, a permanent way. It's mostly an attempt to try and do big injections, but that are one off and don't sort of fundamentally positively alter the welfare state. That's certainly my impression. So I'm kind of pessimistic about some of that. Sorry, that was a bit of a. Do you want to restate the question slightly? I've just gone off for a bit of a tangent.
What can we do that makes that has the same impact, people demanding that we go into lockdown, for example, to protect lives, where the government has shown that they didn't want to do that, but enough people, they realize at some point, well, actually, we are looking like dicks here. How do we kind of use that same sort of exertion of pressure in an environmental sense rather than the pandemic?
I mean, the obvious pessimistic point is, right, so governments have, a whole load of governments, including the UK's, have revealed that they're disastrously bad at disaster management, and we're about to enter a period, like an era of constant disaster. Like that, from 2030 onwards, that's basically it. You can't reverse the disaster, and that it just goes on and on. But we can stop it. So the optimistic bit is what governments have done is show the population that they are capable of doing huge things really quickly at short notice. Some governments better than others, obviously, right? But for decades, certainly since the 80s, and like Thatcher and Reagan, most people in the developed world have constantly been told by government, oh, we can't do that, we can't do that, that's too big, that's too complicated. And the role of the state has constantly been minimized and brought down and brought down and brought down. What they've actually done over the last 12 months to show people that the state has the capacity to do amazing things really, really, really quickly in the general interest of the public. And that's like the big stuff and the small. Like to take a small example, governments across the UK gave councils across the UK money and the power to close off streets, to widen pavements, to make areas pedestrian access only, right? Which is obviously good for, like, you know, air pollution kills tens of thousands of people in the UK every year. It's been really good for that. But actually, what a lot of communities found was people who, like, campaigned so hard to stop a street from becoming pedestrian only, found actually once it became pedestrian only, it was really nice. It was better. It was better for local businesses. It was better for the people that lived there. I mean, there's one ridiculous example of, like, they put a whole bunch of new cycle lanes in all over London, and you can get, like, from east to west pretty much unbroken, apart from now it is broken because Kensington Council ripped up one section of it. And there's a Twitter account you can follow, actually, which is basically just monitoring whether that one fucking BMW has parked on what used to be the cycle lane again. Because that's they took it up, right? Was like basically a small group of people who just desperately wanted to park on that bit of road complained until it all got yanked up. But people across the country realized, actually, shit, see all this stuff that we were told would be really bad? It's actually quite good. And like on other levels as well, as much as like the phrase like Zoom quiz just fills folk with the same kind of existential dread that the impending climate catastrophe does, right? We have all business people who fly who used to fly like every couple of days, were making weekly internal flights in the UK between, like, you know, Edinburgh and London and stuff like that. They didn't actually need to do any of that, and they don't need to go back to doing any of that. What we need now is the courage to say, no, fuck that, right? A, that was expensive, it was ridiculous, it was wrecking the planet, and you can definitely do that on Zoom. And not only does that have like this positive, that has a positive effect, like, because that's the thing, like, people think that we want to like ban flying forever. No, like, your once a year holiday to like Benidorm or Mallorca or whatever is not what's destroying the planet. What's destroying the planet is the guy who flies from like Manchester to London twice a week. Like, that's what's killing it.
Yeah.
And we don't go back to that. We just don't.
I mean, the most ridiculous thing about those, particularly the corporate flights that happen on a regular basis, is that most corporate meetings don't need to happen, let alone you flying to be at a meeting when nothing is achieved.
Yeah, like the heroic death of presenteeism. Like basically, that whole economy, that was like the travel and stuff, that only existed to keep Pret a Manger and like in-house like Danish pastry companies afloat. And I don't know. I totally feel for the staff at Pret who are losing jobs and stuff, but we can create more jobs, better paying jobs, better quality jobs, etc. with the climate crisis. But like the idea that, yeah, you constantly have to turn up for a meeting, which is really just about approving the minutes of the last meeting. Nah, don't need to do that anymore. And if you really desperately feel the urge to do that, if you feel that your life isn't fulfilled until you've done that, well, you can do it on Zoom now, and you can put a picture of your cat as your background, and it'll brighten up everyone else's day.
I do think on those the specifics of the industries where people are being told that they should or could make change. I think flights specifically, I'll have to clarify this in the show notes, but I did read quite recently that something like 80% of the carbon footprint of personal flights is from people flying from major financial cities like London and New York to tax havens. So even if you were flying for legitimate business reasons, potentially that could still be done if we just stopped people, A, having tax havens. That would be a fucking nice start. And then B, going and visiting them.
Yeah, well, I mean, I could get this wrong, slightly wrong as well, but I'm pretty sure that something like 90% of flights are taken by something like 10% of the population. Like, it's the same people constantly doing it to no productive end. Like, not only, like, it's not good, there's no need for them to do it, they could do it on Zoom and all that, but, like, it's generally people from the sections of the economy that everyone else, like, just really hates anyway. Like, do we not think that we could win overwhelming public support behind a proposal to just ban bankers from ever using British Airways again? Like, I'm pretty sure that if there's anything that's going to, like, sweep my party to overwhelming victory, it's not going to be a kind of positive rose-tinted vision of the future. It's going to be slightly vindictive. No, like, why don't we just, like, tax billionaires until they cry and lock them out of their private jets? Like, that's the kind of stuff that people want to see, right? That's the kind of vision for the future that will really get people, you know, not just voting for you, but out onto the streets to help you do it.
Yeah, I also love that the sort of people that bang on tediously about the Pareto principle are also doing a Pareto principle of flights causing climate change. That's nice. But there should be like a, are there like green parties that have the proposal to just say that, you know, there's X billion miles a year of flights allowed to occur, and that everyone has whatever 10,000 or 5,000 miles that they're allowed to use a year or less?
The easiest way to do it is you just make it, you make each flight more expensive than the last. So you replace the taxes that we've got at the moment for flying are basically flat, right? There's just a certain amount of tax on every flight. So your ordinary family holiday to Mallorca, you're paying the same amount of tax that any, like, the guys who fly every single week do on each one of those flights. What you should do, and so the Greens are in government in Sweden and have been introducing this, and it's starting to work, is you make each flight more expensive than the last one, and very quickly you make it so expensive that they can't do it anymore. Because what you actually find is the people who were flying that often, like we said, didn't need to, and the overwhelming majority of people, like 90% of people, aren't affected by it at all, because almost no one is flying like dozens of times a year. Almost no one is flying, like, most people fly one return flight a year if they're lucky. Well, that's fine. You just make the second return flight more expensive, the third a lot more expensive, the fourth a hell of a lot more expensive, and the fifth cripplingly more expensive. Like that, where we've managed to do that, it's not solved the problem, but it's made a massive difference. And it's also fair, because you, like, that's tax, right? That money goes somewhere. You can use that money to build warm, affordable homes for more people. You can use that money to create jobs. You can use that money to pay for free bus travel. In fact, yeah, you should definitely do that. Like, tax the ultra rich for their flights and use it to fund decent public transport so that ordinary people can get to work without it using up half of their day's wages to get there and back.
Ross, I have a question about this is probably a bit more personal than political, but how do you manage the pressure of being both like the kind of one of the youngest representatives of parliament and also being somebody who is passionate about this issue? How do you manage that? Because I did mention before recording that I have seen some brilliant sass from you over on Twitter. Is that something that you are conscious of, that you are trying to kind of inspire younger people to see that you don't have to be some kind of like super square all the time to get into politics? Or is that just something that's natural to you? What's the deal there?
I mean, the first probably disclaimer there is to say that I'm technically young, or at least I was technically young. I was 21 when I was elected. I don't think I've ever been authentically young. Like, I think I've always been to some extent like such a young fogey. I run a whole load of the youth stuff for my church, and like to say that the teenagers can be like accidentally savage to you is an understatement. But clearly, they don't think of me as a young person. But it is nice though, like, to go into school, particularly when you're like, when it's younger kids, and they've heard that a politician is coming to speak to them, and that they think of like middle-aged grey man in a suit. Now, I can't defeat all those stereotypes because ultimately I'm still a white man, but turning up in like Gene's trainers like there to have a conversation with him rather than lecture them. Like, yeah, that does surprise them, and that's nice. But I think part of it is realizing that you're not there to please everyone all the time, and in fact, you would be failing. Like, you wouldn't get anything done in politics if everyone was happy with what you were doing all the time. So one of the first things that I just accepted was like, I'm here to do stuff that a lot of people don't want me to do, but that enough people voted for me to do that I've got a mandate, and I absolutely believe is right. And it can be great. Like, I went to a meeting of the Young Greens, the youth wing of our party, a while ago, back when you could physically go places, and someone came up to me in the pub after and said, "Oh yeah, I joined the party because you came to my school assembly, and you were the only one of the people up there who sounded human." So that was both really nice, but also made me realize at that point that I was already getting fucking old, because this was someone who joined the team because I had visited them at school, but was having a drink with me in the pub because they were years past the point where they were old enough to do that.
If anybody is listening, whether they be from Big Oil or not, who is inspired to actually to try and have their voice heard or to make more of a difference, what do you think is like an actionable bit of advice? Because I think a lot of times we talk about this stuff, or at least I talk about this stuff, drunken in pubs, really angry, but I never actually bother talking to people about, okay, well, if you agree with me, this is what you should do. What do you think people should be doing?
I suppose just pressuring your representatives, canvassing, going out there, trying to change people's minds, not being too judgmental, in the same way that we know that like positive messaging is much better than judgmental or guilt tripping.
Yeah, like first thing is like we won't do this unless a lot of us are doing it together, and you are the single most persuasive person to the people around you. So the odds are most people's friends probably share most of their values. So you're in a little bit of an echo chamber with your friends, but still are speaking to them. Your family, on the other hand, that's usually different. It's pretty rare for everyone in the family to think the same, especially older generations of your family. So like, talk to them about it. Like, if you've decided to vote differently because of the climate, if you've decided to go to a school strike protest to show the young people that you support them, like, tell other people in your family why you're doing that, and like find out what they think about this stuff and have a conversation with them. And like, don't frame it judgmentally, don't frame it like a lecture, but you can be incredibly persuasive. And if you persuade a couple of other people, then next time around, maybe they'll come along to the protest, maybe they'll donate to a campaign group like Friends of the Earth or something. Like, maybe they'll start voting the way that you want to vote. That's all like massively, massively powerful. Obviously, I would say, like, you know, if you like the electoral politics side of this, get involved in a political party that you think matches your values and will do something about this. But there's loads of other ways that you can get involved as well. And like, one personal thing that I think Every adult who certainly works in the public sector should do, but if you're in the private sector and you've got a pension, you should do this as well. Check where your pension is invested. Like, this is one of the single biggest blows that we can strike to the fossil fuel industry, is divesting pension funds. There are trillions and trillions and trillions of pounds invested in these fossil fuel companies, and a huge amount of it is being divested. The Catholic Church just divested like $40 billion on its own. The city of New York's divesting about $250 billion or something like that. Massive amounts of money. And everyone in the public sector should have like a pension fund through that. Most of them, certainly every pension fund in Scotland and most across the UK, somewhere along the line, they're invested in oil and gas, they're invested in fossil fuels. So check with your pension fund. And if they are invested in fossil fuels, start lobbying the board, because the board of, if it's a public sector pension fund, the board is made up of trade union reps, elected councillors, that kind of thing. If it's a private one, it'll be a little bit different. But if you're looking for like one specific action that you can take, if you feel frustrated that the lifestyle environmentalism, you know that's not doing enough, but you're not maybe quite ready yet to join a political party, to go out on protest marches or whatever, just check where your pension fund's invested, and if you're not happy with it, tell them that and tell them you want it divested.
And that was that. How great was that? So as Ross and Alex both said, I think this is the sort of thing where there's a bunch of organisations, both political and non-political, that you can get involved with. But the important thing is that we all do. It's such a vital issue for us that we keep this going. And so
please keep doing whatever you can. I'll talk to you next time. As I said at the start, if you've enjoyed the episode, please tell a friend and subscribe. Thank you. I'll talk to you then.